The Takeaway is supported by TechServe, offering troubleshooting and repair services for broken or problematic Macs, iPads, and iPhones, both in warranty and out. More information at techserve.com.
This is The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry. Thanks so much for listening. 4 million Syrians on the move. You see their faces, their desperate crowds at checkpoints, the hopeless drowned bodies of toddlers, mobilizing the world to try and understand what we are seeing. The history of civilization is the story of vast movements of people to escape oppression, to inflict oppression. This hour, we ask the question, what are we seeing right now?
Change happens.
My friends, nearly everything around you is going to change within this generation.
Offer ideas to change it.
The conditions for such change.
The Constitution is not meant to facilitate change. It is meant to impede change.
What really changed last week?
Game changer.
Change we've got. But what are we seeing right now? The Takeaway's deep look at the unprecedented complexity of this moment in history. Change, populations in motion, instability, assumptions about family, gender, society, and nation-states being challenged by technology, a growing population, and the breakdown of traditional institutions. Is this the change Obama and the rest were talking about there? I think not. What are we seeing? We'll talk with brilliant writers Nick Kristof and Cheryl Wu Dunn later this hour. But what do you think we are seeing in the world right now? This isn't like the end of a war or the fall of an empire or the invention of the light bulb. It's bigger, but we can see it all unfolding, our gift and curse in this 21st century. Your thoughts at 877-8-MY-TAKE. We'd love to hear from you. We begin with the population motion in the Middle East, though. 4 million migrants have left Syria in the 4+ years since the civil war began in 2011. We will set that number into some historical context in a moment. But unless someone snaps a heartbreaking picture of a dead 3-year-old, this is a challenge for the world.
We need to look at them as persons, as human beings, and stop referring to them as numbers. These are really people, families, grandfathers, mothers who flee for their life.
That's Lindis Hurum from Doctors Without Borders, who spoke to us while on board the Bourbon Argos, normally an offshore tugboat supply ship that has been refitted for rescuing refugees and migrants in the Mediterranean. Hassan Shibley joins me now. He's Chief Executive Director of the Council on American-Islamic Relations in Florida. Hassan, do you know what it's like to be treated as just a number?
Thankfully not, because I came to this country at a younger age when I was 4 years old. And the reason we came to America from Syria was because my father was receiving a lot of harassment because he wouldn't join the Ba'ath Party in Syria, where he taught at the university there. In fact, he was thrown in jail because he went to the mosque too often. So we came to America at an earlier age and were able to establish ourselves. And it's just, as a Syrian American, I find it very difficult to reconcile how I'm treated because I have this American passport. I can travel the world. I can go where I please just for vacation or for pleasure. And I see my cousins and I see millions of Syrians really struggling and thousands dying to seek a better life. And they can't travel. They can't seek the same opportunities that I have simply because I have a different passport than they do.
Just a personal question. Do you have it in you to do what these people are doing?
You know, I don't think I would have survived in Syria. Very simply, I'm very outspoken. I'm a civil rights attorney here. My whole purpose in life is to challenge oppression and challenge injustice. And even where I am in America right now, I get attacked by extreme anti-Muslim bigots in this country. And I also get targeted and threats from groups like ISIS. And that's here in America. So I'm sure had I been in Syria right now, I think I would have had a lot of enemies and either would have been attacked by them or forced to flee. So I'm very lucky, as I said, and I don't believe I should be entitled to any special treatment simply because of the passport that I have. And
but Hassan, you weren't an attorney when you were 4 years old.
No, I wasn't, but I was, I think, known from my childhood ages to be questioning authority. In fact, whenever I would visit Syria growing up, I actually planned to move to Syria back in 2006. And the reason I didn't is I was just horrified by the utter corruption that I saw over there in the Syrian government. The fact that we couldn't question authority, we couldn't point out injustice, and that people with wealth and authority could do whatever they please and people could not speak out against it. So I actually went to Syria in the summer of 2006 with the intention of moving back there, and after 3 months said, no way, let me go back to the States. And that's actually what inspired me to become an attorney, because I realized what makes America great is our legal system and our principle of justice and the rule of law, and that's what Syria is lacking. And so I decided to invest my life in contributing to our legal society here in this country.
But Hassan, what if you found yourself in that wave of humanity? And as a four-year-old, a six-year-old, depending on how long it would have taken you to cross the Mediterranean to get from Southern Europe to Western Europe and then across the Atlantic to the United States, what would it have taken out of you? What would it have required from you that as someone with survivor's guilt has to really calculate as you look at these pictures?
Well, I think the Syrian people are very determined, are very resilient, and I think that's just a reflection of human nature. And I think these people, that especially those that are refugees, those that have survived the atrocities of the Assad regime, survived the atrocities of ISIS, and had to give up everything they ever lived for all their life, their possessions, their family members, their relatives, to seek security. That's what they're seeking. They're not seeking luxuries. They're not seeking the wealth of Europe or the wealth of the U.S. They're seeking just to be able to sleep at night without having to fear being decapitated by a terrorist group or being blown up by Assad's bombs. So they're seeking survival. And because of that, I think they have a lot that they can offer and a new appreciation for life. And I think not only will they benefit by seeking a new life in Europe, but I really believe Europe and the U.S. will benefit by having some of the most ingenious and resourceful people contribute positively to society, because they're going to come, they're going to start businesses, they're going to contribute to society. In fact, some of America's greatest people were Syrian immigrants. Steve Jobs, who founded one of the most profitable company in the world now, Apple, is the son of a Syrian immigrant. And I think what they've been through will only give them a stronger appreciation for life and help them contribute better. I am already in touch right now. We've actually decided to open my house up to refugee families. And the refugee families that are coming, they were media producers, they were mega businessmen over there in Syria, and now they want to come and start fresh here. And I think they have a lot that can contribute to society because of their experience, not in spite of their experience.
Let's talk a little bit about what these pieces of paper mean. I was looking at the map this morning. The people from Syria are crawling out of a territory that was originally traced by, I suppose, sort of biblical, lines on a map. For centuries, it was part of the Ottoman Empire. And then, in the 20th century, it's really a territory that's created by the British Empire and the European Empire. And then they land in Southern Europe, which is a map that was created by the end of World War II, make their way to Western Europe if they can. And if they find sanctuary, that's great. But if they come to America, they're also arriving in a place that, as a map, is the function of political issues that have nothing to do with humanity and are often obstacles for people to get into the country. I mean, Donald Trump is talking about building a giant wall to keep people out. What do these pieces of paper mean in your view, and as you look at these pictures of Syrian refugees?
The world's changed. I don't think we can afford to just be American citizens or Syrian citizens or German citizens. Rather, I think we need to be part of, world citizens. The world's now grown a lot smaller with the advance of technology. And frankly, what happens in America affects what's happening in Syria. What happens in Syria affects what happens in America. And, when problems affect the world, it's not going to simply look at your passport before it affects your life. We have to start seeing, I think, the world more globally and value human life for what it's worth, and not simply because of these artificial boundaries and arbitrary boundaries that have been drawn, and often drawn for the sake of failure. I think what we're seeing today in the Middle East is, in a sense, by design. I mean, it's the result of, as you mentioned, the Sykes-Picot Agreement, which drew often arbitrary lines in the sand, but lines that were drawn with the purpose to create division, lines that were drawn to separate minorities like the Kurds and not give them a homeland, lines that were drawn to empower certain minorities to rule over many majorities to create conflict and tension. And not to mention more recently, the conflict that we're seeing is a direct result of our illegal and baseless invasion and occupation of Iraq, which destabilized the region. So we've contributed significantly, whether we as the Western world, including Europe, or we as America in the last decade, have contributed significantly to the current political crisis in the Middle East. We have to take ownership and we have to help contribute as well.
Hassan is the chief executive director of the Council on American-Islamic Relations in Florida. He joined us from WUSF in Tampa. We reached out to Hassan after he posted on our Facebook page in reaction to the photo of three-year-old Aylan Kurdi, who drowned crossing the Aegean Sea from Turkey to Greece. He wrote, "When I can travel to Europe to vacation in Paris on a whim, but my cousins cannot enter Europe to escape death by a murderous dictator, something is seriously wrong with this world." Leave your story, share your thoughts at facebook.com/thetakeaway. That's 4.1 million displaced persons from the conflict in Syria alone. The United Nations estimates that nearly 60 million people worldwide are on the move today because of conflict. What are the pillars of history that bear up this story of humanitarian crisis, failure, and success of peoples to help each other? Well, there are two pillars, actually, and they have the same theme song, you might say. On this day, the current monarch on the throne of the United Kingdom, Elizabeth II, becomes the longest-serving monarch in British history, surpassing Queen Victoria, whose record had been 63 years, 7 months, and 2 days. And boy, it was a very different map of the world in 1952 when Queen Elizabeth ascended the throne.
Queen Elizabeth II, by the grace of God, Queen of this realm and of all her other realms and territories, head of the Commonwealth, defender of the faith.
As I speak to you today from Cape Town, I am 6,000 miles from the country where I was born. But I am certainly not 6,000 miles from home. Everywhere I have traveled, in these lovely lands of South Africa and Rhodesia, my parents, my sister and I, have been taken to the heart of their people.
Rhodesia, Burma, names from another time, Queen Victoria's time, Gilbert and Sullivan's time.
I am the very model of a modern major general. I've information, vegetable, animal, and mineral. I know the kings of England, and I quote the fight's historical from Marathon to Waterloo in order categorical.
Queen Victoria ruled over a world that was in motion, like today. But 82 million people moved voluntarily to seek a better life during the Victorian period. Add to that the forced migrations in Europe of Jews and other ethnic groups. You get perhaps 6 million additional. African slavery in decline, but still the numbers are humbling, 10 million. And then in 1890, in China, what would become a flood of 25 million people migrated from the south to Manchuria, helping to set up the conditions for war in the Pacific.
Just remember till you're home again, you belong to me.
By the time this song was popular in the British Empire in the early 1950s, not much belonged to the crown anymore. An empire much diminished by war and Britain's inability to afford its vast empire, the Europe Queen Elizabeth viewed was very much defined by the disruptions of World War II just ended. 19 million dead, 30 million displaced by Hitler and Stalin alone. More than 10 million European refugees ended up in more than 225 camps around Europe, and their resettlement to reluctant host countries was as controversial then as the migration from the Middle East is today. So as we congratulate Queen Elizabeth for surpassing Queen Victoria on this historic day, we also note this curious possibility. That while Queen Victoria reigned over a world that was giving birth to nation states with new flags and new anthems born out of a colonial bloodbath, perhaps Queen Elizabeth II is reigning at a time when the usefulness, the morality, and the relevance of those same nation states is crumbling. Our time. You know, that Disney movie Frozen's classic battle of sisterhood just might have been inspired by the enduring Williams sisters. Venus versus Serena Williams at the U.S. Open last night. Younger Serena won in the end. But birth order never bothered Serena anyway.
We are very, very tough competitors on the court, but, you know, once the match is over, the second it's done, you know, we're sisters, we're roommates, and we're all that.
It was quite the pressure cooker at the U.S. Open quarterfinals last night. On the line for Serena, a grand slam, winning all 4 single titles in the same calendar year. She still has to win the U.S. Open. But to get there, she had to face her sister Venus. On the line for Venus, older sister pride, family legacy, a soft touch for the little sis, who knows? but it was operatic and Freudian to watch the 27th meeting between Venus and Serena as pro tennis players. Courtney Nguyen, senior writer for WTA Insider, was at the match. Welcome back to The Takeaway, Courtney.
Thank you.
It was a potboiler in my living room last night with my three daughters, two twin sisters watching this, trying to imagine what they would be. What was it like at Arthur Ashe Stadium?
It was, it was the coronation in a lot of ways of just those two sisters coming together, 17 years of what they've contributed to the sport as a pair. And it was tough, I think, for that Arthur Ashe crowd. They didn't really know who to back.
Who did you back?
You know, I'm an older sister, personally,
for me. That's so huge.
Yeah, for me, I just related to what Venus Williams was going through out there, you know, to her younger sister who has surpassed her in a lot of ways, obviously in the record books and still dominating the sport, and Venus still kind of struggling a little bit to stay relevant and to really challenge for titles. I felt that story. There was a resonance there. And so on that level, I was kind of rooting for Venus just to make it a tough, good match.
But it's tough. I mean, if you're the oldest.
Absolutely.
You can't win. Venus couldn't win last night.
If she took it
away from Serena, ouch.
Yeah, I mean, there's always kind of a no-win situation whenever those two have played. You know, I mean, everybody thinks that there's some sort of something untoward going on in behind the scenes. But I think if you watch that match, you saw how hard each of them fought. And that was one of the best performances I've seen from Venus Williams in a very long time. Just really clean. At the end of the day, she's not as good of a tennis player these days as her sister. And that bore out in the scoreline. You know, I was thinking about it a lot with my younger sister. And I was thinking, man, I don't think that I would have had the fortitude to go out there and perform as well as Venus Williams did against my kid sister who was going for history, trying to rewrite record books. I wouldn't have been able to do it. I would have lost 6-love, 6-love in 20 minutes. And I'm an incredibly competitive person. But,
my daughter said the same thing. They couldn't have handled the emotional pressure. It didn't matter what their talent was, that's for sure. What do you make of the visual transformation in women's tennis because of the Williams sisters over the last 17 years?
I mean, it's impossible to ignore just the racial makeup of the tour in terms of how much it's changed. I mean, you look at a lot of the young talent, especially among the Americans on the WTA tour, and you're looking at Madison Keys, you're looking at Sloane Stephens. These are a whole bevy of young players who grew up seeing Venus and Serena compete, win major titles, and thought, I want to do the exact same thing. And I'm very much a believer in you got to see it to be it. Billie Jean King always says that, and I think that makes a difference.
But it even goes a step beyond that, I think, also, in that these guys broke down barriers, Venus and Serena. But in Serena's case particularly, she defines supreme excellence.
She does. That
transcends tennis.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think that's why this story of her going for the Grand Slam in New York has really captured the imagination of everyone, because it's an opportunity for us to really reflect and appreciate what Serena Williams is, because for the most part, tennis has its certain place in the United States and people maybe aren't paying attention and maybe take for granted what Serena Williams has been able to do over the course of her career. And in this moment, people are stopping and they're taking time to really reflect on what she's done. And it's absolutely incredible. She will go down as one of the greatest female athletes ever, if not the greatest female athlete ever. It's not a question for me.
Yeah, exactly. No qualifier.
It's just an incredible thing that she's doing. She's 33 and still dominating a sport that's supposed to be for kids, you know?
Okay, now we've kind of blown it. I mean, that was just the quarterfinals.
Yeah.
She's got to win the U.S. Open.
She's got to win.
So who does she face between now and the end of the tournament?
So next up for her is a surprise semifinalist named Roberta Vinci, 32 years old from Italy, ranked 43 in the world. No one expected Roberta Vinci to be in the semifinals, but then in the finals, she could potentially face one of three players who's actually given her a good amount of trouble over the last 12 months. In number two, Simona Halep. You also have Petra Kvitova, who handed her one of her two losses this year. And then you have Victoria Azarenka, who everybody's always said Azarenka's the one who's going to potentially challenge Serena. Has played her twice in the finals here in New York. So if one of those three makes it through, we're in for a pretty great final.
You're already making me nervous. Here are what our listeners are saying about the sort of birth order issue here. From Texas, my brother is 2 years younger than I. We shared a bedroom throughout our childhood. We did not get along. We were rivals for everything from our parents' attention to who got the larger bowl of cereal. Now in our 40s, we are as close as two brothers can be. We were best men at each other's weddings. My parents always said, you'll be glad you have a brother someday.
And were they ever right? I think Serena and Venus get along.
They do. They do get along. And it's always been one of those things where as Serena was growing up, she wanted what Venus had. It's that typical little sister, big sister thing. And Venus was a champion. Venus was winning matches. Venus played tennis. I want to play tennis. And I think in a lot of ways, when you look at both of them, there is no Serena without Venus. Venus broke down a lot of barriers for her sister. It was an incredibly polarizing figure, being the first of the Williamses to come through. So in a lot of ways, she paved the path and allowed and gave Serena space and kind of protected her little sister. I always think it was a weird thing because her father, their father, was always very adamant that Serena was the better of the two. He said this back when they were teenagers. And so I always wonder, again, because I relate to Venus, I wonder what that must have been like.
A couple more here. Charleston, South Carolina. My brother and I were competitive in every sport we ever played growing up. I would always beat him in every sport, and this forced him to continue to try new sports because we both hated to lose. He stumbled upon the game of golf, and it turned out that he was destined to make a living in the sport. And from the day that he decided to take the game seriously around the age of 14, I don't think I have ever beat him, although I continued to try.
This is Nassim from Silverton, Oregon, and I have never faced a rivalry with my two siblings, but I have to say I do appreciate the grace and support both of the Williams sisters give to one another. It impresses me, and I think it's a great role model for everyone.
Sisters rule.
Sisters rule.
That's the lesson.
It is the lesson. That's what I said. I was like, you know, last night was about sisterhood. That's what that match was all about, and it put it front and center, and it was very cool to be a part of.
Courtney, thanks so much.
No problem.
We'd love to hear your stories. 8778-MY-TAKE is our number, and there's much more at thetakeaway.org. Courtney Nguyen is a senior writer for WTA Insider. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
Here's a question. Does your national anthem give you goosebumps or push you to choose between a political identity and a deeper human identity? Earlier this hour, we asked the question looking particularly at the migration crisis out of the Middle East, but also at other deep changes afoot in the world, and asked, what are we seeing right now? Unlike so many of the watershed events in world history, fall of the Roman Empire, the Soviet Empire, French Revolution, Mao takes over China, Vietnam War ends, the 9/11 attacks, what we see now is an intense but murky swirl of technological change, political disruption, institutional dysfunction, it seems, stalled political leadership around the world, poverty, extreme wealth, gender influx, a pope from no nation throwing out the rule book in a secular world and becoming perhaps the most important leader in this new century. I could go on, but I won't. What are we seeing? Who better to start our series and our discussion of this than Pulitzer Prize-winning Nicholas Kristof and Cheryl Wudunn, welcome.
Great to be here.
Their book, A Path Appears, Transforming Lives, Creating Opportunities, is now out in paperback. Even that seems obsolete, paperback. The world is changing so much.
Although paperback sales are actually up this year and ebook sales down a little
bit so far this year. What are we seeing? And you're talking about a challenge to institutions, sovereign nations, at a very ground level in your book.
Yeah, I mean, I think one of the changes that we're seeing is that globalization connects the problems in one country much more quickly to those in another. And so you have Ebola in Liberia, and quickly you have Ebola in a lot of other places in the world. You have problems in Syria, and soon you have problems in Europe. And I think one of the traditional problems that we've not been very good at addressing is the kind of strategic issues. And, you know, we always are much more willing to fund a pound of cure than an ounce of prevention. I hope that one of the lessons of this right now is going to be the importance of addressing problems early on, whether they be Ebola in West Africa, whether they be Syria unraveling 200,000 Syrian refugees in Jordan, getting completely cut off food aid in ways that are going to drive them to Europe. And in this country, we do the same thing. We are very willing to fund criminal justice and very unwilling to fund early childhood education, which will reduce the need for that kind of spending. So, which is something we talk about in A Path Appears. So, I do think that problems are becoming very interconnected in ways that should impel us to try to address them earlier on.
But I see political institutions embracing the contradictions that you describe in your book, the insane contradictions, invest in this ridiculous thing and ignore this thing that's much more efficient. and people on the ground picking up and taking the initiative on their own. It seems to me that if you look at the Syrian civil war or the breakdown of the financial system, political institutions, and with the exception of the Federal Reserve maybe, are not up to the task of this sort of thing.
That's exactly what we see, that the role of the individual is far more important now than it has been in the past few decades. We, as individuals, you know, citizens here in the U.S., used to think that, oh, well, the institutions, they run by themselves. They function on their own. I mean, you know, they don't need any help from us. But that's actually not true. We do see the breakdown of these institutions. And institutions, of course, are run by people. And so that's why it's really important for individuals to see how they can play a role in, you know, changing attitudes and reshaping some of the roles that these institutions have had. They have to, these institutions have to be more flexible. They have to change and grow. But I don't think that right now our structure allows is allowing for, partly because individuals aren't really saying that they care.
But there are so many contradictions in the world, and in South Asia particularly, many have asked the question, why doesn't this explode? And what instead happens is it coexists in this bizarre sort of way that is dysfunctional, but there's not the kind of conflict that we would imagine from, you know, 1789 and the French Revolution.
I mean, but partly that's because indeed there is progress. And I would push back a little at the idea that everything is dysfunction. You know, you had a guest on earlier talking about the 60% improvement in child mortality since 1990. Since then, the number of kids, primary school age kids who are out of school have gone from 100 million to 60 million. So, poverty worldwide, extreme poverty has diminished. So on some of the issues that matter most in the world, there really has been some progress from institutions, albeit those that are pretty fragile, pretty frail, often prone to corruption. But you know, I think in South Asia, for example, you are seeing a backdrop of a certain amount of progress that relieves some of that pressure.
But Cheryl, is there a collision between the hope that's represented by some of those epidemiological and public health statistics and this idea that we're seeing in the migrant crisis and in statistics like, you know, a billion people don't have access to clean water, that, you know, okay, you live to five. But beyond that, you know, the economy of the world doesn't have that much necessarily to offer. And so there are going to be huge numbers of displaced people emotionally.
I don't think there's a collision. I mean, I don't think that they are sort of targeting each other, sort of the progress of science versus the particular institutions. I think that they realize that they have to coexist, and that the progress that we have in healthcare around the world, both, you know, abroad and here, I think that's really important. And that's continuing. I mean, there's a relentless march, which is fabulous, because there are great inventions that are taking place. There are scientists who are really dedicated to, you know, bringing about innovation and change. On the other hand, you know, institutions to deal with migration, we don't really have these great institutions. We also don't yet have sort of a groundswell here in the U.S. of people saying, wait a second, you know, we really should play a role in this migration crisis, and force our institutions to say, wait a second, maybe we should, you know, take some more, you know, refugees.
Maybe we already have with the Iraq invasion. I mean, you know, there is that.
There is some of that, but I think that it's, you know, obviously this is a fluid situation and it's ongoing. I mean, I think that's not something that, you know, individuals or Americans can say, okay, well, we've made a decision on that and therefore, you know, we can move on.
Yeah.
I mean, this is a constantly changing environment.
Well, it's so interesting how immigration may be the issue that challenges world governance to work in the way that war and, you know, conflict resolution actually hasn't worked in our time. Getting back to your issue, though, of individualism for a second, it seems like that's a particular challenge, an explosive one in China, that the more individuals who come out in the middle class and say, oh, we're going to do things ourselves, the more potential that has for global destabilization if things don't go right in China.
Well, right now, I think that it is very well kept in check. I think that the government in China and the Communist Party in China is very, very keenly aware that they don't want things to get out of control. And President Xi Jinping has been masterful in using nationalism to rally the Chinese behind his vision of China, which is very different from his predecessors. I mean, it is not clear that the U.S. and China is in a sort of harmony between the U.S. and China is a key part of his vision. His vision is a strong China. And I think a lot of Chinese can get around that. So obviously they do care about other things like the pollution. They want the government and the party to really, you know, clean up that country. And so there are individuals who are trying to work towards, you know, making that occur faster. And they are protesting the pollution. But
who works inside the system and who works outside the system, that's really the key to
where
things go
forward.
Well, most
of them, I think the change right now is through the system and not outside of the system, because you'll just be crushed at this point. And I don't think there are too many individuals who are going to take to the streets at this moment.
Nicholas Kristof and Cheryl Wudunn, thank you so much for coming in.
Oh, it's
Thanks
a pleasure.
For having us.
Nicholas Kristof and Cheryl Wudunn, their book, A Path Appears, Transforming Lives, Creating Opportunities, is now out in paperback. And you can hear anything on today's program. Just go to thetakeaway.org or call us at 877-8-MY-TAKE. Thanks so much for listening. I'm John Hockenberry. This is The Takeaway.
Support for The Takeaway comes from the Henry Luce Foundation for increased understanding of East and Southeast Asia. The Takeaway's resilience reporting is supported by the Rockefeller Foundation. For more, go to rockfound.org.
PRI, Public Radio International.
I'm David Remnick, host of the New Yorker Radio Hour. There's nothing like finding a story you can really sink into that lets you tune out the noise and focus on what matters. In print or here on the podcast, The New Yorker brings you thoughtfulness and depth and even humor that you can't find anywhere else. So please join me every week for The New Yorker Radio Hour, wherever you listen to podcasts.